Station number 17626, Mr. Thomas Lawton, Reel 6.
Mr. Lawton, Reel 6. There'll be a sports side to the camp with inter-battalion...
Very important. Sports were very important. You had your company sports, and you had your battalion sports, and you had your brigade sports. And I was a very good runner. The cross-country run, I never won it, and I went it every year, and I always came in second. And there was a little fella called Crawford, Suey Crawford. He could always beat me. And it used to be about 5 miles over country, not. But I was a good country runner. I was a good boxer. I wasn't any good at football. Funny team sports thing. I didn't. But yes. Now, your guard competition was part of the sports competition. Eh? Because that was very important. As I say, they would carry them on rather than let them get their boots dirty. And your sports, you held them in your company, your platoon held them in your company, then the battalion, and then the brigade. And there were some good prizes we used to get, even for going to shoots. We used to get nice little plaques. We used to get little medals. Your running and all that thing, eh? And all those things, you know, today would be very important, but I lost all mine in Dagenham. I left them in a box for a man to send back, never got them. And I even had a cup from Lady Tankerville, Lord Chillingham Estate, for being. I won the race, I won the five mile cross country, and they presented this cup. And it also included what was considered the best man in the camp. The most important man in the camp. This was a camp on the Lord Chillingham Estate composed of out-of-work miners. And at the time I was working in Dagenham, I came up for a fortnight's holiday and I went and saw the chief of that camp. They were going to the various dole offices. And men were going and asking about, because they thought, it's free, what he called, forced labour. And the students were explaining. And I said, could I go? Yes. Everything was free. Had a canteen there. But of course, it was for the Cambridge and ex-Cambridge students, run by the Cambridge University. Everybody was Peter and Nunk, you know. And the students, so you had a camp leader, you had a tent mate. I was the leader in our tent, 8 men, and we won everything that was going, with the exception of the tug of war. Number 8 tent. Lady Tankerville presented a cup, and it was for the most outstanding man in the camp. Well, we naturally thought it would be one of the students. And there was a student there, they called him Lawson. Ted Lawson. We used to call him Horsey, because he wanted to join the artillery. And when they shouted the name, number eight, we got the cups, we got the medal, we got everything. No, for the most outstanding man in the camp. And they shouted the name, I was saying. And we had a couple of them. And my tent mate, Bottomley was his name, but they called him Bumley. He comes and says, well, aren't you going to go and get your cup? I said, what cup? That cup. I says, no, I said, well, they called your name out. Tom Lawton. I thought it said Ted Lawson. Me. Well, I went and got my cup. Now, all those things were in a box down in Dagenham. And when I got to Gilly Move to come back up here, I said to my wife, right, we'll leave that crate with the next door neighbours. It was one of them crates, you know. Oh, I had encyclopedias and all kinds of it. And they said, dude, send it up. And I remember I gave them, I think, £5 at the time. I said, it'll cost that to send it up. And it never arrived. And all those little plaques, all those little medals, all those little cups, which today the kids would love, right? I never got them.
When you joined the Terriers, you were put into a platoon, were you?
Into a platoon.
What was your platoon?
A section and a platoon. I was here, number 3 platoon. There'll be 4 platoons in the company. I was here, number 3 platoon.
And each platoon would be divided into so many sections?
Sections, 4 sections. Simple. You formed 4s. You had 4 platoons in the... 4 sections in the platoon, 4 platoons in the company, 4 companies in the brigade. All right. And then you got that special company, yes. That made 5 in the brigade.
And this was riflemen?
Riflemen.
Were there any specialist squads? Yes.
The machine gunners. MG, carried MG on their arm. And the machine gun company was a small company at Washington. They did not... Yes, at Washington, there was a small company. We called them the machine gun company. They never drilled with us. They never trained with us. The only time we saw them was when we went to camp. And they carried an MG on their arm. As the Lewis gunner carried an LG. And we thought that must be wonderful. To us, the machine gunner, or the machine gun section, or whatever it was important compared with us, because we were just riflemen.
You didn't get any training on machine guns,
no,
did you?
No, not whatsoever.
Now, in addition to the fortnightly camp, did you do weekend camps occasionally?
Yes. Occasionally you went on a weekend camp, and it was more or less manoeuvres. You go up in the country, and there'd be some scheme, and he carried out manoeuvres. And a very important thing was, keep down. Keep down. No matter where you were, keep down. Everybody was keeping down, you know, because you didn't have to be seen. Right? And sometimes you take advantage. We saw a certain sergeant that was always one there called Coffee. He was a nervous bloke. When he tried to give an order, I was like, and I was imitated an officer's voice. Then, get down, sergeant. Sergeant, keep down. And he's getting lower and lower. And the bloke says to me, oh, Tommy, man, never do that. Yes, weekend camps were generally more or less manoeuvres. And although it was a weekend, you didn't go away and say overnight. It seemed as though you did the weekend all in one day. It was the hours you put in, I think. And you didn't get paid for that. It was like when you went for your shoots at Chesney Street, get a pie and a bottle of beer. Well, that was very nice. Weekend camps, yes. Route marches, yes, occasionally. You'd have a route march. And the route march was usually worked out so it took in the likes of the Fell Bank, then up onto Shaden's Hill and across the fells, so that you weren't tramping the roads like you do normally. It was really a route march.
How easy or hard were they to the soldier?
The what?
How difficult was a route march to you? Was it heavy work?
No. You see, the majority of men were used to hard work. And they never took buses. No, just buses that weren't as handy. Nobody had cars, so everybody walked. And to go to Chesney Street. We'll go to Chesney Street, right. And if you and I were going to Chesney Street, I'll say, I'll tell you what, Harry, we'll run and walk, eh? Right. So we'll walk 100 yards, run 100 yards. Walk 200 yards, run 200 yards. By the time you got to about 800 yards, you were in Chesney Street. Yeah? Everything was, well, that's what it was. You walked and walked and walked. So a route march was very enjoyable when you went across the fells, because so many fellas in the heavy boots tripped over bits of turf and fell down, you know, and of course that caused a laugh. It'd be pretty great this. If the enemy was over there, eh? The one thing, they didn't have any bullets up the spout. No bullets. Empty guns. It was done in a nice manner.
Did you have a rest after a certain period of time?
We used to... Aye, this is good. 10 minutes rest every hour. Oh. It got to the point where I said, wait, hold on. Where's 10 minutes rest every hour? It's about time we had a rest. Because it's nearly 10 to 12 now. Oh. You couldn't force in them. No. After you've gone for an hour, you have 10 minutes rest. Doesn't matter what time it is. Oh, no, they went off the clock. The 10 minutes to the hour, stop for 10 minutes. And that caused a lot of conversation. And it was the way it was given over. Instead of saying, right, 10 minutes rest every hour. After you've marched an hour, you want 10 minutes rest. They said, no, they want the 10 minutes rest in the hour. Right? Why, that was union work, you know. And they were big, strong upholders of the unions. And as a matter of fact, there were some cases when you did things, they would say, you know, we shouldn't be doing this. If the union got now, we'd be doing wrong. Like, all right, we'll drain so-and-so's field. It'll be good exercise. And he's allowed us to go on there camping. We'll drain his field. What a job. If the union got now about this, man, the union, you've got no to do with it. I mean, we're a union, man. And we're doing this on a Sunday afternoon, you know. Right? And that was always there. And, of course, this was so strong with the socialist side. That's what more or less drove me around to thinking, well, you're something wrong. Do it because the man is let went to his field and he wants his drains clean, and then we'll do it for him. It's good work for us. It's good practice. Chillingham Castle, where the wild cattle are, the first thing you did was look for a tree to scramble up. Not that the wild cattle would ever trouble you unless you were between them and water, or if they were having calves. They'd never trouble you. But we all had a tree marked out to get up. And those students were there, and the first time I saw a cine camera, one of the students came along, Harold Hunter. He came from Constance, and he was going in for the clergy, and he was the camp leader. And he came along and he says, I say, chaps, I'm going to have some photographs. So everybody's standing on our shoulders, you know. No, he says, just carry on. Well, so I want some photographs. Yes, but it's a camera, it's a film camera. It's a films. Oh. We didn't even know what it was. Cine camera. We learned a lot from our betters. We learned a lot from what our betters. Men who should have known better, but were hidebound with the unions and such like. But they were all good soldiers. And they were all pretty clear thinking. You would never tire them. I went once on a course, field engineering. And on field engineering, they even taught you how to use a shovel and throw a muck. And I said to one of the instructors, I'll bet I can throw a shovel of muck farther than you can. What do you mean? I said, I'll bet you I can shovel a muck farther than you can. And I says, when I say shovel a muck, I don't mean spreading out like that. We aim for something. And I said, we'll put a square across there somewhere, and the whole of that muck's got to land in that square. That's got to spread out. He had a clue what I was talking about. I says, that's not shoveling, just chucking muck anywhere. I says, shoveling is to be able to put it where it's got to go. I says, in the pits, you'll be wasting your time and wasting money spreading it out like it. It's got to go where you want it, into the tube or onto the belts. Ah. I once went on a civil defence course, and they were talking about the shell went in there, and it came out there. I said, never. And the instructor, was the main instructor, he was cousin to, the man was, he was nearly prime minister in this country. He was very well taken with. He used to have a little fancy touch at the beginning of the war. This man was a cousin to him. And this man was also an ex-naval commander. The shell went in there. I says, never. What? I said, never did. And the rest of the men, I says, look, if a shell went in there at that angle, it couldn't possibly come out yonder. Aye, how green was my valley. Commander Eden, Lawton, have you ever heard of jinking? I says, what? Jinking? No. That shell jinked. I don't understand, sir. It went in that angle and it hit a hard point and jinked upwards. Oh, yes. So you learn, you see.
Did the territorial, or was the territorial soldier more able to talk that way to an officer than, say, a regular soldier?
Oh, yes.
He would question more than a regular.
Oh, yes. I can't see that. Can you explain that to me? Can I see it? They would have no compunction. And why should we do it that way? Why can't we do it this way? Beginning of the war, now, Hyde, as you know, are there the experts. They send out the tests of elementary training. Eh? TOETs for this, TOETs for that, tests of elementary training. That's the time you should be able to do that in. When they introduced the Bren gun, Akak mounting, they sent out the test of elementary training. That's the time it's got to be done in. I was walking along, they were down by the weir at Chester. And there was a sergeant who said, Sergeant, come here. What's the test of elementary training for Akak mounting? Oh, I said, offhand, I couldn't tell you. But you know, they're a book. He said, because these men can knock 2 minutes off it. I said, they can't. He said, they can. I says, that's from a hive. He says, they can. I said, I'd like to see them. So he says, right, that section fall in. There it is, Akak mounting. I says, do that again? They did it again? I said, that's wonderful. I couldn't get back to tell the brigade major that we had men, militia men, who could knock 2 minutes off the high time. He wouldn't believe it. I have to see with my own eyes. Right, sir? They did it very simple. According to Hyde, what you did was you put the tripod up, then you mounted the gun. Not with these lads. And these were militiamen. These were from factories. They were tradesmen. They formed the tripod on the ground, and they put the gun on, and they hoisted the lot up together. And when it came up together like that, they were behind the gun. Gun ready for firing. The brigade major couldn't believe it. He says, oh, a letter to Hyde.
And they'd work this out themselves. They'd devise this themselves.
That's what I'm saying. They were skilled men. You know, they were from factories. And they must have said, wait, hold on. It takes you that long to put then, you got to put that on. Why not do the thing all together like a Meccano set? And that's exactly what they did. And when I saw it was so simple. The only trouble was that would be a little bit difficult on hard bottom or on a floor. You'd have to steady the legs. But in the grass, very quick. Yes, there was a lot of things. Even to the sloping of arms when you were on duty, on bridge duty. And with your arms sloped like that and the bearded on, you had to keep tilting your rifle to get underneath the arches. When I said, well, why don't they carry the rifle on the sling arms? What? Sling arms? With a fixed bayonet? Why not? Oh, I mean, that's not the drill book. The militiamen and practical men could pull a lot of rogues away out under the hive people or anybody else, because they used common sense, they worked it out, and they knew they could do it. Some good lads in the militia.
Can we talk a little bit about bayonet training?
What bayonet
training did you get?
Well, I would say that in the territorials you got no bayonet training. If you did, they had a ring on a stick. But you see, the charge, you know, in, out, and away, we didn't have the stands for them like that in the territorials. So if they give you any bayonet training, they say, no, to be able to deal with a bayonet, see, you've got to get it through that ring. No, that's his throat. That's good. But the action that came in after we became embodied, where you had the stands and you had the straw, the sack on, that was different. Then you got cracking at it. No, don't be too keen. Don't be too keen or you'll bayonet yourself. You'll trip up. Oh, no. There was lots of things. The forming of force. When I realized the black shirts were falling in threes. No forming force. Falling in threes. Then I learned that European armies all fell in threes because of narrow roads and defense, I see. Common sense. But you try and tell the terriers that. No, the drill book says you fall in the toes, number, little odd numbers this way, even, then you're in fours. I said, yes, but why can't they just fall in threes like that? You can fall in threes and file or in line. And then it's done. And it came to be, but not through me. It came through the upper brass, seeing what was happening elsewhere. There's lots of things. Carrying things and that. A stretcher for it. Carry a stretcher. You didn't carry a stretcher like that, man. What are you doing? No, you don't. You carry it over your shoulder, not under your arm. Oh, why? Not oh, why? There's a reason for it. You can travel quicker with it over your shoulder. And you're just the same height as if you had it under your arm. And when you get there, you can whip it off your shoulder. A lot of things the territorials and the militiamen didn't agree with from the drill book. And on one occasion, I was having my hair cut in the drill, in the ballroom. 150 militiamen there. And the sergeant come to me and said, hey, Sammager, the brigade major's just come in. I said, the what? The brigade major's just walked in. Fellingham. Right. So I dashed down, I saw the officer, whoever he was. I said, the brigade major's in the hall. What? We didn't know. I said, no, we didn't know. I says, normally we can see him coming from his office, wherever a spout stood. When I go down at the hall, all the men are sitting there. The brigade major's on the platform. Sorry, sir, have me hair cut. All right. And the officer comes, didn't know you were here, sir. No, came by surprise. I just want to ask these chaps, what do they know about regimental history? You never taught regimental history. And the terriers, you used to learn it if they wanted it. But the militiamen, anyway, not like they had 8 weeks intensive training. And these are militiamen. And the brigade major, now then, hey, no trouble. Answer. I was astounded. I looked at the officer saying, he couldn't ask any questions which those men couldn't answer. He was over the moon. If he'd asked me, I couldn't have told him. And he went away delighted. And he was, I mean, the officer and me were good blokes because we taught the men regimental history, see? We didn't even know much about it ourselves. And when he got away, I went down among the lads. I said, "Here, come here. How do you know so much about regimental history?" "Well, we read it there." "Where?" "Behind that door." There was a door, and on the back of the door there was a chart that big, regimental history. And when these lads were in at a weekend, couldn't get out, they didn't waste their time. They sat there asking each other questions about regimental history. And the brigade major thought that I was a good bloke, and so was the officer, because we definitely taught those men. And we didn't even know the chart was behind the door.
So you basically, in the Terriers, you didn't teach regimental
history? No. If anybody's interested in it, well, you could buy it.
How did you bring forward a regimental pride situation in the men?
What?
The pride in the regiment. How was that formed in the men?
Well, you see, the Faithfuls. What? The Faithfuls, the Durhams. The Faithfuls. Ah. And you see, the Durhams was formed from the Welsh regiment, right? The 2nd Durhams, no, 1st Durhams. 2nd Durhams formed from the Calcutta, from the Bombay tradesmen. Mm-hmm. They were always to be relied upon. They were good fighters. And if you read any regimental story, you'll find that wherever the Durhams were, they were pushed into the dirty, per se. So, for instance, after the war, I used to go across to Newcastle, the YMCA. The wife was working in the ordnance factory then. She'd finished school, went to the ordnance factory. She was a first lady convener. And I used to go across Newcastle to the YMCA. I was sitting talking to an ATS staff sergeant one day. She says, "You must be a proud man, Sergeant Major." I says, "Yes." I said, "What makes you say that?" She says, "Well, Durham Light Infantry." "Oh." She says, "You know, I'm in the Peer Corps. I never heard of the Durham Light Infantry." But she says, "I always remember on certain sessions when all the casualties coming through, DLI, 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 DLI." And the officer in charge said, "Yes, there's been a nasty business on somewhere that pushed the Durhams in. They'll do the job." Right? Well, what could you want more from the ATS lads? So we used to teach the men that. Don't forget the Durhams. Fellingham, Brigade Major, Christmas time. On parade, everybody, before the Christmas leave. "Now don't forget, men, you're going home to your fathers and mothers and your families. Remember the badge you're wearing? The Durham Light Infantry. And if you look at that badge, you'll find there's a crown and two coronets on it." Did you know that? "Oh. Now, I know you'll want to go for a drink. When you go for a drink, you go into a pub and it's packed, the bar. Don't stand back. Just say, 'Excuse me, please. Excuse me. Excuse me, please.' Be polite till you get the bar. Get your pint and drink it like a man. And when you've drunk it, turn round. And if you're going to do it again, 'Excuse me, please,' till you come out. And when you come out, they'll say, 'Wait, was that Durham Light Infantry man? That's who he was.'" And all that kind of thing was used. And of course, when a fella like Montgomery turns round and said he knew he was all right, he had the Durhams on his right flank, he was safe with the Faithfuls.